We are looking at the book of Habakkuk. This will be the third time that we have been looking at this passage. And I've chosen this little booklet just because of the times in which we are living. Things are changing quickly around us. And this is a book that I think shows us the mystery and yet the comfort of the doctrine of God's providence. For the people of God to know that our God is sovereign, that he rules and reigns above, and according to Paul, that he is working all things after the counsel of his own will. And for us to get a grasp of that is vitally important for us as believers, for the various things that we face in a fallen world, for the various things that we see around us, to rest and trust in our God and to know that he is sovereign, his purposes will prevail. And as you know, Habakkuk was a man who is a perplexed man. He's a prophet. And what we have is a dialogue between him and God, and we're able by the inspired word to listen in on the conversation that he has with God. And he poses the question to God. He's perplexed as he looks at the nation about him, and he's troubled as he sees violence and he sees iniquity and trouble and contention and strife, and it seems that the law is powerless and justice is not going forth. It was very difficult for him. Lord, why are you doing something? And then the Lord responds to him and he replies and tells him exactly what he is going to do. And this is even more difficult now because he says he's going to bring in the Chaldeans, verse 6. Indeed, I am raising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation which marches through the breadth and of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. And this is what I'm going to do to bring judgment upon my own people, to chastise them. And so as he thinks about this, now he's got a greater problem. Lord, how can you use a nation so wicked to come in and to do this to your people? I know that you are the everlasting God. I know that you are holy. I know we shall not die. The Lord has a purpose yet. But I just really struggle with the instrument that you are using to bring this about. And I know that you are of purer eyes than to behold evil. You cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when the wicked devours a person more righteous than he? And so here is Habakkuk, the perplexed prophet. And it is in this situation that we read in verse 1 of chapter 2, he says, I will stand my watch. Here is the wisdom of this man. I will stand my watch and I will set myself on the rampart. And I will watch to see what he will say, what the Lord will say to me, and what I will answer when I am corrected. I know the problem's with me, it's not with God, and I am going to wait. And here's the wisdom of him, to hear from his God, to see what he can't see, and to learn from the Lord. So the Lord answered me, verse 2, and said, write the vision and make it plain on tablets that he may run who reads it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it will speak and it will not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it, because it shall surely come and it will not tarry. What I'm telling you, you can write this down, be assured of it. It is going to come to pass. And so we come to chapter 2 here, and we'll be looking at this briefly tonight. But we have seen that God is sovereign. 2 weeks ago, we looked at the doctrine of the providence of God. And the providence of God is God working out his purposes in the world in a very practical way. He is sovereign over all things. And he is accomplishing his purpose, his goal, his plans in the midst of this world. And history is the unfolding of God's plan. There's a lot of mystery in this. how God, the sovereign, holy God, works in these situations. But we know this, and there's mystery, but there's also comfort in this. So we talked about the providence of God, that He is sovereign over nature. He's sovereign over the universe. He's holding all things together by the power of His word. Christ is holding all things together. He's the one that brings the wind out of His treasuries. The snow falls at His bidding, at His word. And so He's sovereign over these things. And then we saw that He's also sovereign over kings and kingdoms. We see that right here in Habakkuk. He's the one that's raising up the Chaldeans. We see that in Isaiah 10. The Assyrians, he said, they are the rod of my anger. He's going to use them to bring judgment upon the northern tribes. And they fell in 722 to Assyria. So here is God bringing judgment of using another nation. He's the sovereign over kings and kingdoms. The king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it whichever way that He pleases. And then He is also sovereign to bring about good. He raised up Cyrus. He's even named 150 years before he was ever born. And He said, I'm going to raise up Cyrus, and it is Cyrus who will overcome the Babylonians, and he will be the one that will allow the children of Israel to return back to their land, and he will bring them back to rebuild. So here, in one sense, God uses a nation and kings, and He brings about judgment. And then He also uses a king, who's a pagan king, to bring about a positive thing for His people. And so we recognize that God is sovereign and He is in control. And it's helpful for us to know that, especially as we see a lot of changes in our nation, things that are hard for us, difficult for us. And we know that sometimes God's judgment not only comes upon individuals, but it comes upon nations. Genesis 15 talks about the... How's that verse go? You were just quoting to me the other day. The Amorites, the cup of judgment is not yet full. Something like that. Yeah, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. And yet, after 400 years, God's going to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt, bring them into the promised land, and He's going to bring judgment upon those nations there. And so God brings judgment upon nations. He's sovereign over nations. And He is also sovereign to accomplish those things. And we think of our own nation. There are many things for which we really are ripe for the judgment of God. We pray that He would be merciful and extend mercy to us. But we look around us and we see a lot of things. I read recently of a man who said this, that when people stop believing in God, the Creator God, the next thing they lose is common sense. And I tell you what, you watch what's going on in politics in our country, and you think, yeah, we've lost just common sense. And I read this week about PETA. The protection, what is it? The protection, people for the ethical treatment of animals. And they wrote this post, a tweet, and it's an appeal to humans asking them to stop using animal names as verbal insults toward other humans. Why? Well, doing so constitutes supremacist language, for one thing. Instead, PETA said, if you want to insult someone you believe lacks bravery, don't call that person a chicken. That would be insulting to chickens. Instead, the animal rights organization suggested, call that person a coward. And if someone tends to tattletale or constantly report others' behavior, don't call that person a rat. He ratted on me. use snitch instead. In addition, say jerk instead of snake, repulsive in lieu of a pig, and lazy instead of sloth. Words can create a more inclusive world or perpetuate oppression. Calling someone an animal as an insult reinforces the myth that humans are superior to other animals and justified in violating them. PETA added in the tweet, stand up for justice by rejecting supremacist language. We're just another animal. When Genesis says we were made in the image and the likeness of God. PETA finally concluded with the following. PETA urges everyone who believes in equality and justice to take a look at their personal beliefs and the language they use and break free of this outdated mindset that denigrates other animals. Always be kind and consider not using insults at all. So we see that, and we see what's going on in so many different areas, and we think, where is even just common sense? But this is the world that we are living in right now, and we recognize that, you know, as I think about this, this could be the judgment of God. One of the ways that God can judge a nation is to give them over to their own foolishness, to give them over to their own sin. And I pray that God will have mercy upon our nation, but that could be what God is doing. I'm not a prophet nor the son of a prophet. I pray that's not the case, but it could be. But anyway, we are called to be faithful nonetheless. So he's sovereign over kings. He's sovereign over kingdoms. And I concluded 2 weeks ago with this statement that really might test whether we believe in the providence of God. If we had God's power, we would change everything. But if we had God's wisdom, we would change nothing. That's a strong statement, isn't it? Do I really believe that? Do I really believe that God is sovereign over all the details concerning my life? Do I trust him? William Cooper said, God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and he rides upon the storm, deep in unfathomable minds, with never failing skill. He treasures up his bright designs and he works his sovereign will. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessing on your head. Tonight, as we look at chapter 2 briefly, we want to see here God's providence relative to the Chaldeans, relative to his enemies that he is actually raising up to bring judgment upon the nation of Israel. And so we have here God giving five woes against these people. And I want to read this quote. This is by Gable Line. He says this, the second chapter consists of a taunt song made up of a series of woes upon the Chaldeans. The form is quite regular, consisting of five strophes and three verses in each strophe. Taken together, they provide a striking exemplification of the principle so concisely stated in the first part of verse 4, the despot has within him the seeds of his own destruction. If tyranny is suicide, these vivid maledictions show us exactly why. And so here the very nation that God is raising up, these Chaldeans, the Babylonians, he is also going to hold them accountable for what they do and for their sins, and he is going to bring judgment upon them. Now, here's where, you know, we don't understand how all that works. God is able to turn the heart of a king, and yet he's responsible. God doesn't make people sin, but God uses their sinful bent to accomplish his purpose, and they're accountable for their sin. And we see that here in chapter 2. So we see that God's providence that he raises up this nation and they are responsible and they will give an account for their sin. So we have these five woes. It's kind of similar to Matthew 23, where Jesus pronounces woe to you scribes and Pharisees over and over again. That's what we will find here, these five, in this poetic fashion, these five woes against the Babylonians. The first one is in verses 6 through 8. And we find here a woe upon them because of their unholy ambition. They are seeking after other nations and gobbling them up. We'll start at verse 5. Indeed, because he transgresses by wine, he is a proud man, and he does not stay at home, because he enlarges his desire as hell, and he is like death and cannot be satisfied. He gathers to himself all nation, and he heaps up for himself all people. So here is grabbing as many peoples and nations as he can. It's a picture of Hitler, isn't it? As he went and sought to expand his kingdom, taking other kingdoms, other nations captive. Verse 6, will not all these take up a proverb against him and a taunting riddle against him and say, woe to him who increases what is not his? How long? And to him who loads himself with many pledges. So here he is. He's just bringing in all these nations. Chapter 1 describes it like a fisherman throwing out his net and bringing in these fish. And it's kind of the way the king of Babylon is and the nation as they go and take other nations. And so they take advantage of them. Verse 7, will not your creditors rise up suddenly? Will they not awaken who oppress you, and you will become their booty? So what goes around is going to come around. What you do to others is going to come back to haunt you as well. And that's what's going to happen to Babylon. God is going to use the Medes and the Persians, Cyrus, and they're going to overthrow the Babylonians. 25 years after Nebuchadnezzar dies, that's exactly what happens. And so these very nations that he conquers will then in turn come back and they will conquer him. So here is God bringing judgment upon them, even by those who were swallowed up by them. Galatians 6:7 says that whatever a man sows, he's going to what? He's going to reap. God will judge. He will judge. And he will bring to justice all things one day, and sometimes in time in history, but certainly at the end of the age as well. And so there is this unholy ambition, the first woe. And then the second woe, we find what we might call the woe against covetousness or injustice, or we might say imperialism. Verse 9. Let's go back to verse 8. Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the people shall plunder you because of men's blood and the violence of the land and the city and all who dwell in it. Woe to him who covets evil gain for his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of disaster. So here's a picture of the nation and of the king as being covetous. This is one of the Ten Commandments, isn't it? You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his servant or his ox. Covetousness can lead to some very ugly realities. It's not just a sin of the heart. It is often expressed then in one's life. David is one who coveted his neighbor's wife. And it brought all kinds of harm to him and to his neighbor. And here is this coveting and wanting more and more. It's a horrible thing to be a slave to covetousness. And as Christians, we need to learn to be content, to be contented. But here's this covetousness that cannot be satisfied. And notice what it says in verse 9. He covets evil gain for his house, that he may set his nest on high. that he may be delivered from the power of disaster. There's this idea of, you know, growing his kingdom and his nest is up high. It's this idea, this picture of security. He's safe from all enemies. He's in a safe place. And when I was reading this, I thought of Hitler. Hitler had what he called, what was it, the eagle's nest? And it was, where was that? Was it in Austria? The Alps? Okay. And if you watch the Band of Brothers, I think it was actually filmed there, wasn't it? And it's this high mountain, and he's got this elaborate place there where he would go on retreats. But God can bring a man down from his nest. Turn back to Obadiah, just back a few books, three or four books back. And we read in Obadiah, verse 4, this is a vision against Edom, God's judgment that he's going to bring on them. Though you ascend as high as the eagle, verse 4, and though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, says the Lord. And so it is here with the nation of Babylon. I will bring you down. He goes on and he says, you give shameful counsel to your house, cutting off many peoples, and sin against your soul. For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the timbers will answer it. So this fortification that you build, even the stones are going to cry out against the sinful ways in which you have treated others. They will be a witness against you. And so there is this covetousness. And then we see the third woe. There is this bloodshed in verse 12. Woe to him who builds a town with bloodshed, who establishes a city by iniquity. Behold, it is not of the Lord of hosts that the peoples labor to feed the fire, and the nations weary themselves in vain. So here he's building his kingdom, his empire, this vast empire. It is through bloodshed, and it is through iniquity that this is being done. And are not our history books full of this, of these kinds of things? And so, woe to you because of the bloodshed. You remember when Cain had killed his brother Abel, and God came to Cain and said, where's your brother? And he says, am I my brother's keeper? And what does God say to Cain? What's crying out? The blood is crying out from the earth, from the ground, this murder that you have committed. So even though Babylon is an instrument in the hand of God, they are accountable and they are going to be judged for their sin. Then we have the next woe, the fourth woe, and it's in verse 15. This is a woe of their debauchery, their immorality. Their God is their belly and they live for their own lustful desires. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbor, pressing him to your bottle, even to make him drunk, that you may look on his nakedness. So drunkenness leads to a lot of other things, doesn't it? A lot of shameful, wicked things. You are filled with shame instead of glory. You also drink and be exposed as uncircumcised. So again, what you do to your enemies, God's going to do to you. The cup of the Lord's right hand will be turned against you, and utter shame will be on your glory. They're going to be brought to shame. For the violence done to Lebanon will cover you, and the plunder of beasts which made them afraid because of men's blood, and the violence of the land and of the city and of all who dwell in it. And then the last one we have is the fifth woe, which is woe to them because of their wicked idolatry. All that they do as idolaters. Verse 19. What, or 18. What profit is the image? What profit is the image that its maker should carve it? The molded image, a teacher of lies, and the maker of its mold should trust in it to make mute idols. Woe to him who says to wood, awake, to silent stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, yet in it there is no breath at all. And so here is woe to them for the sin of idolatry. They are worshiping the creature rather than the creator. And God will not give his glory to another. And there will be judgment upon this nation because of this sin of idolatry, as well as these other sins. They do all of this, and God takes notice of it. Though he uses it, he will judge it. Now, as we look at this, we see his providence in relationship to his enemies, but now we also see his providence in relationship to his people. We see three eternal principles that are woven into the text here. One of them, the first one, is that God's purpose for his covenant nation is not off course. That God is going to fulfill his purposes with regard to Abraham, the things that he has said that he will do. And we have in Deuteronomy 8:28, there God says that if they obey him as they come into the land, he is going to bless them. He'll bless their farms. He'll bless their orchards. But if they don't, he is going to bring in judgment. Listen to these words in Deuteronomy 28. Think at verse 49. The Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the ends of the earth, as swift as the eagle flies, a nation whose language you will not understand, a nation of fierce countenance, which does not respect the elderly nor show favor to the young. They will eat the increase of your livestock and the produce of your land. This is but a fulfillment of what God had told to children of Israel under Moses at Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, that there is going to be cursing or blessing. If you obey me, I will bless you. If you don't, I will bring judgment. And we see that God is doing that. God, with relationship to his covenant nation, is bringing judgment upon them. But here we find these three principles that are in this book that remind us of God's purpose with regard to his people. Sandwiched in between the third and the fourth woe, we read these words in verse 14. For the earth, well, let's go back to verse 13. Behold, it is not of the Lord of hosts that the people labor to feed the fire and nations weary themselves in vain. All that the Babylonians do, all that the wicked nations do, it's all in vain. Why? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. The glory of the Lord is going to fill the earth. These nations are going to fail. They will not accomplish their ultimate purposes. They will fail. And we know this, that the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord, even as the waters cover the sea. And so here is this promise. Here is this expectation that the people of God have, those who belong to God, that this will be the end, that his glory, the knowledge of God, is going to fill the earth. And we'll get to that when we get to 2 Peter, as Peter speaks about this new heavens and this new earth in which righteousness will dwell. God will be known by all those who inhabit the new heavens and the new earth. So in contrast to nations who in their sin and corruption build their cities of iniquity, all of it is in vain. The big picture for the believer is that God will prevail. His kingdom will prevail. And every tower of Babel is going to be brought down. Every city of man is going to be ground into dust. Why? Because the purpose of God will prevail for his people. And so even though times can look bleak for believers, and that's the way it's been throughout history, look at church history, sometimes some very dark times, look at even in the Old Testament from very dark times, we have this assurance that God's purpose will prevail and he will not fail. He's sovereignly working and moving and acting to accomplish his purpose. A second thing we see is verse 20. But the Lord is in his holy temple. In spite of the idols of these individuals, what they have made that are just wood and stone, Habakkuk, know this, the Lord is in his holy temple, and let all the earth keep silence before him. And I think this is similar to what David says in Psalm 46:10, be still and know that I am God. I should say God says through David, be still and know that I am God. God is sovereign. God is in his holy temple. So let the earth keep silent before him. Trust him. Rest in him. And then the third one is what we have in verse 4, a well-known verse in the book of Habakkuk. It's quoted three times in the New Testament. Behold, the proud, his soul is not right within him. It's not right. It's going to come under the judgment of God, even though it seems that he is prevailing. His soul is not right, but the just shall live by his faith. The just shall live by his faith. And this is quoted by Paul when he's speaking about the doctrine of justification by faith alone. We're not saved by our works. We're not saved by the things that we do. No one is justified, he said, by the law in the sight of God. It's evident. And he goes back to Habakkuk and he says, the just shall live by faith. And this faith which we live by is a faith that it's not just a saving faith. We do believe and we're justified by faith alone, but it's an enduring faith that we continue to believe. So this word suggests trust and faithfulness and steadfastness and firmness, persistency. When the days are dark, when things are hard, the just shall live by his faith. Faith in the Lord, in his promises, in his word, and what he is going to accomplish. And so, as he says to Habakkuk, verse 3, this vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it will speak and it will not lie. And though it tarries, wait for it. Trust and rest in the Lord. Let me read one more quote just in closing here. This is from a man named Charles Feinberg. He said, the prophet was to reduce the vision to writing so the people would have it for the future. The deliverance would not come immediately, but it was sure to come. The godly would wait for it. Delay is only in the heart of man. God is working. The details according to his own plan. Patience was needed. The purpose of God cannot be hastened, nor can it be delayed. It comes at his appointed time. And we do need patience, don't we? We want God to intervene now. We want God to act now. And this is one of the things that we must learn as we learn to live by faith, is to wait upon God, to be patient, to know that he's sovereign. He will accomplish his good purpose. Next week, we're going to look at the end of this book. It's got a glorious, triumphant ending. And we have a prayer of the prophet, and it closes with a wonderful statement of his hope and his trust in the Lord. And in these days, may the Lord give us such faith to keep our eyes fixed upon Christ, upon the promises of God, knowing that his purpose will prevail. Christ shall have all that he has purposed to accomplish. He will have his people in the last day, and there is no one who can oppose him and his purpose. All right, well, let's stand and we'll be dismissed with a word of prayer.